This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The UN has called the mass killing, rape, and destruction of villages in Darfur crimes against humanity. But the UN Security Council remains deadlocked over what to do about it, and today postponed a vote on a Sudan resolution. My guest, John Prendergast, has been working on conflict resolution in Africa for about 20 years and is a special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. His most recent trip to Sudan was in January. What have been the big sticking points at the UN Security Council over its resolution on what to do in Sudan?
Fortunately, there are layers of complexity in the deliberations in New York now. The first issue, probably the most contentious one, is whether the crisis in Darfur and the perpetrators of the crimes against humanity that have been committed there will be referred or not to the International Criminal Court, to the ICC. And the French lead a European contingent in demanding that that referral be made. The U.S. Bush administration famously is viscerally opposed to the ICC and, of course, opposed to its referral, even though the U.S. has been out front on the demand that there be some form of accountability for the crimes that have been committed.
I think the U.S. doesn't want to be a party to the International Criminal Court because it's afraid that Americans might someday be tried in it.
Particularly the Defense Department. When I worked in the Clinton administration, this was an issue that transcended both Democrat and Republican parties, that the concern exists that American troops serving in peacekeeping missions abroad could be brought up on charges. I don't think that's possible personally, but enough people do that it became a very strong concern within the Clinton administration and has become a matter of ideology in the Bush administration in terms of opposition to the court.
So has the American refusal to sign any resolution that includes the International Criminal Court, has that been the major sticking point?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest one in terms of the first step of getting a resolution. It's related very directly to the fact that the U.S. is strongly supporting the imposition of targeted sanctions against regime officials in Khartoum, whereas the Europeans are very strongly opposed to that. So you have what is basically a standoff between the Europeans and Americans over both the ICC, which the Europeans support, and the targeted sanctions, which the Americans support. But lingering in the background, of course, and smiling broadly, are the Chinese and the Russians, who both are willing, or at least say they are willing at this point, to veto any bill that comes out, any resolution that comes out, demanding sanctions or referral to the ICC. So there are two layers of obstacles we're dealing with here on the issues of accountability, the European-American divide, as well as the threat of the Chinese/Russian veto.
Now, does oil in Sudan have anything to do with how members of the Security Council are likely to vote?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with it. I think that if you follow the money trail here, you see that four out of the five members of the UN Security Council, the U.S. being the lone exception, are invested heavily or lightly in the Sudan oil sector. Four out of the five, in addition, are selling arms or brokering arms deals to the government of Sudan. So we have fairly vested economic interests that, again, if the U.S. doesn't muster the political will to break the logjam, we simply won't get meaningful multilateral action on Darfur because of these economic interests and the political issues related to sovereignty.
So if this UN Security Council resolution passes, what would it do to help stop the crimes against humanity in Darfur?
It would simply be a first step, I think. It's a very weak resolution, by the way. And even if it did pass in its strongest version, it would just be a parted solution to the international community's necessary response to the crimes that have been committed in Sudan. However, if they did pass it, a fairly robust version of the current resolution, then I think it would begin to alter the calculations of the regime in Khartoum. At this point, 2 years have passed in which this, what the Bush administration calls a genocide, has unfolded in Western Sudan. During those 2 years, not one punitive measure has been imposed on the orchestrator of these crimes, the Sudanese government. And so once you start slapping scarlet letters on the regime, on the officials of the regime, through targeted sanctions like asset freezes and travel bans and an arms embargo, then you start to affect their calculations. This is not the Taliban, this is not Saddam Hussein. They're not looking to go down with the ship. These guys want to be players in the international system. If they are finally called out in a specific way, in a punitive way, their behavior will be altered rapidly. It is terribly unfortunate that we haven't been able to muster the international political will to slap such a minor sanction as a travel ban on these guys, because I think it would have a very rapid impact on their actions on the ground in Darfur.
My guest is John Prendergast, special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. We'll talk more about Sudan after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Prendergast, special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. He's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years. We're talking about Sudan. The civil war in Sudan recently ended. A long civil war was recently ended through negotiation. How is that civil war connected, and how isn't it connected to the massacres in Darfur?
There are multiple poles of opposition to the government in Khartoum. Of course, the regime there in the capital is a minority clique that took power in a military coup in 1989, represent a very small percentage of the country. And the southern rebellion, southern-based rebellion, is the longest-running armed element of that opposition. In fact, the war went on for 21 years and was only settled 2 months ago after a very, very long and concerted diplomatic effort. Darfur is connected to that very directly because in two ways. One, it's a symptom of a larger malaise in Sudan, which this small clique of people in the center of the country control most of the power and wealth, so most of the periphery wants a slice of the pie, and they'll do quite a lot, either militarily or politically, to challenge that status quo. And so, of course, the people in Darfur, the people in the east, the people in the far north, share the sentiments of the southerners that they're being cut out. But secondly, I think the Darfur conflict is connected to the south because the way the negotiations unfolded in the south is that they didn't allow, the negotiators, including the United States, didn't allow any other group in Sudan to be part of the negotiations. They just had a bilateral forum between the government and the southern-based rebels. So the Darfurians, who wanted to be part and parcel of these negotiations, who were cut out, basically judged themselves to have one option, which is to shoot their way into a negotiating process. So they started their rebellion in early 2003, the armed aspect of their rebellion, and the rest is history.
I'll confess, I'm still really confused about what the fighting in Darfur is really about. I often read that it's about the Arab migrants versus the black farmers, but it seems like it's also really about larger political issues. So would you give it your best shot at explaining what the fighting in Darfur is really about, what the bottom line is?
I think in the first instance, all these wars are very complicated, but in the first instance, the people that were able to move and create an actual armed rebellion were motivated by the fact that they're being completely cut out of the political and economic structure of the country, that there is a pie that's been cut up, and they're not part of it. And there's a lot of money flowing in Sudan these days with the oil, and the power commensurate with that money is very attractive. And people in Darfur see their chances to have a piece of that slipping away, and that certainly was a partial motivator. But I also think there are underlying ethnic and regional and other social elements to the reason why the war began. There certainly is a history of rivalry between communities, between Arab and non-Arab communities in Darfur. But those rivalries were being stoked more and more over the last decade by the government, because it has maintained power, like most dictatorships do, through a policy of divide and rule. And when the rebellion began, which was a rebellion largely of non-Arab peoples against the government, it was a very easy decision for the government to say, okay, if that's where it's going to come from, then let's arm the most heinous sort of radical element of the Arab community, which is the Janjaweed militias, which represent a very, very small minority of sentiment of the Arab people in Western Sudan. Let's arm them to go after these people and do the kind of job, the military, and carry out a military strategy of counterinsurgency, which became, in effect, genocidal. And I think that that the combination of these political and economic factors, along with this history of social division, were the principal kind of ingredients to the conflict cocktail in Darfur.
You know, civil war is one thing, but when you get to near genocide or what the UN calls crimes against humanity, I mean, that's a level of brutality and sadism that's like above and beyond civil war. Do you have any ideas of what could help explain the unconscionable brutality that has been going on there?
There actually is an internal rationale to the actions the government has perpetrated during the last 2 years. They very clearly wanted to send a message in the context of their military operations to other parts of the country. That message was, look here, if you want to oppose us militarily, this is what you're going to get. So there was a predisposition to a very, very strong incommensurate response to the rebellion that unfolded in Darfur. But more importantly, I think, the oldest trick in the book, the oldest strategy in the book of war, is when you fight a counterinsurgency campaign, you drain the water to catch the fish. You destroy the asset base, the civilian population base of a rebel group, and you ensure that that rebel group no longer has an ability to gain safe haven, ability to resupply itself from a sympathetic civilian population. So what the government of Sudan did was conduct a military counterinsurgency strategy that literally wiped out the people from under the rebellion. And they stripped out the non-Arab population of Darfur and forced them into these what are effectively concentration camps, these displaced camps throughout Western Sudan, thus denying the rebels their ability to move around, which crippled their military capacity. So it was actually a very successful military strategy. You know, and 200 or 300 years ago, people probably would have yawned and said, what a nice campaign. But now we have such a thing as an international human rights movement. We have international law. We have laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, and, of course, the Genocide Convention. And the Sudanese government has grotesquely violated all of those. And unfortunately, as we've already discussed, the international community, the response of the international community is largely what it was 200 or 300 years ago, a big yawn. We haven't done nearly remotely what is necessary to combat or counter these horrible crimes.
Something else that's happened is Rwanda. Members of the international community were saying we can never let anything like that happen again, and yet what's happening in Sudan is similar. So what lessons do you think were learned from Rwanda and or could have been learned from Rwanda?
You know, we learn a lot. We never apply it. I think that that what's happened during the last decade is the international community, particularly the United States, has become more and more adept at providing humanitarian assistance, what are largely band-aids over these crises. We spend more and more money, and we congratulate ourselves for how generous we are, either in the aftermath of the things or even while they're happening. But with respect to the actual cause of these humanitarian catastrophes, the horrible human rights abuses that are perpetrated on civilian populations, we have done not one iota different. Our actions are entirely consistent with what we did in Rwanda, which is a big zero. And I think, you know, we have a symbolic force. There was a symbolic force in Rwanda, as we all know, during those 100 days. For the last year of the 2 years of the crisis in Darfur, we've had a largely symbolic force.
You're talking about the African Union?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, I think we know how to do lip service very well. I think that's the principal lesson, is we've learned to immediately talk about things, immediately say how concerned we are, to even call genocide by its rightful name, which, of course, the Bush administration famously did 6 months ago. But we simply are unwilling. It's not unable. It's not incapable. We are unwilling to then expend the political capital necessary to create the kind of policy that would actually confront the killers, that would actually end the killing.
You describe the African Union as a largely symbolic force in Darfur. Do you think that the problem with the African Union's force is its size or its mandate?
I think the problem is both the size and the mandate, and the problem is that they are not backed up sufficiently by the United States and the European Union. The mandate is inadequate. It needs to be strengthened. It needs to be, the objective of the force needs to be the protection of civilians. That needs to be the purpose that we are about right now, and it is not that. Secondly, I was stunned by a newspaper account that I saw earlier this week that the French government, in its application to host the 2012 Olympics in France, is willing to put 41,000 police officers in Paris alone, while at the same time the entire world is not yet able to put 2,000 troops on the ground in Darfur, a region the size of the entire country of France. I mean, the disparities just slap you in the face in our choices that we make as a society and as a global community. So I think that the Darfurians are largely left to fend for themselves. And the African Union force, I have no doubt about the intentions of the African Union. It wants to do something good. It wants to help the people. It wants to protect the people. But it's not backed by the international community, particularly by the Security Council, to do what it needs to be doing right now, which is protecting people.
My guest is John Prendergast, special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. He's been working on conflict resolution in Africa for 20 years. We're talking about Sudan. In the 90s, the Sudan had become a haven for terrorists. Bin Laden lived there after leaving Saudi Arabia before going to Afghanistan. Is it still a haven for terrorists? And does the chaos and the violence and the crimes against humanity there now affect it as a place for terrorists?
I think there are two really important points to make about terrorism in Sudan. First is that the world's reaction, particularly led by the United States, to Sudan's role as a supporter of terrorism, makes the point about why aggressive and robust action now could stop the crimes against humanity in Darfur. Because in the 90s, in the mid-1990s to late 1990s, the U.S. led a campaign through the United Nations Security Council to isolate the government of Sudan for its support for international terrorism. Because of very small measures being taken through the Security Council, the Sudanese government changed its behavior almost completely with respect to terrorist organizations. It kicked Bin Laden out of the country. It dismantled the al-Qaeda infrastructure that had been constructed during the last 6 years from 90 to 96. And it cut a lot of the ties that it had with a number of other terrorist organizations and individuals. There's empirical evidence that if it's pressured, the government will change its behavior. That has a very direct relevance to the situation in Darfur. The second point that needs to be made about terrorism in Sudan is that our ongoing, the United States' ongoing relationship with the Sudanese government to try to address counterterrorism issues has led us to have relationships with individuals in the Sudanese government hierarchy who are directly responsible for orchestrating the crimes that have been committed in Darfur. And I worry that the extent of our relationship on counterterrorism with the Sudanese government has in fact obstructed the United States from taking more bold and assertive action against the regime for the crimes that it's committed in Darfur. And you can't prove intent on the part of the U.S. government or motivation, but the empirical evidence exists that the U.S. has been very soft. Outside of rhetoric, the U.S. has been very soft in its actual dealings with the Khartoum regime and the actions that it has undertaken in Darfur.
What do you think the international community could do to stop the killing in Darfur?
I think it's really, really clear. Rarely do you have, as an African advocate, in my 20 years working on these issues, such an obvious answer. We need to buttress the African Union force immediately. We need to support it with a stronger mandate, and we need a lot more troops. And NATO needs to get involved and help with the expansion of that force rather rapidly. On the flip side of the same coin, we need to focus on accountability. There has to be an agreement in the Security Council or elsewhere that sanctions, targeted sanctions, be imposed on this government, that their case be referred to some form of tribunal. The ICC is the right answer, but it may be impossible because of U.S. opposition. But there has to be some accountability for the crimes that have been committed. If you get those two rolling down the track in the right direction, we will see a very rapid turnaround in the situation in Darfur.
When was your last trip to Darfur?
I went about a month and a half ago with Paul Rusesabagina, the main character from Hotel Rwanda, and I went, and we also brought Don Cheadle, who acted as Paul in the movie, and we brought Nightline with us, and we went across from the Chadian refugee camps into Darfur, and explored around and tried and interviewed people all throughout Chad, the refugee camps, and in Darfur. So it was about mid-January I was last there.
Now, you were also there over the summer. Had the situation changed much?
I think it's gotten much worse. I think the biggest threat now is that we're looking at the possibility of famine in certain locations in Darfur. And I think, in my experience, the only thing worse that you could possibly contemplate than genocide is genocide topped off by famine. So I think we are we're approaching a moment in Darfur that could get much, much worse because of the food security situation.
I'm interested in what you think the impact of the movie Hotel Rwanda has been. And are you ambivalent at all? I mean, on the one hand, it's wonderful that the movie has raised awareness of what's happening, you know, of what genocide means. But at the same time, are you frustrated that, well, that's what it takes? You have to make a major Hollywood motion picture with, you know, a star of the stature of Don Cheadle in it.
3 weeks ago, I've been working on these issues for 20 years ago, and 3 weeks ago, my mom called me and said, well, your dad and I just went to the movie Hotel Rwanda. We finally understand what you've been doing all these years. So, well, of course, it's a little frustrating that it requires a major motion picture. But nevertheless, it's there. The cards have been dealt. And I think this is a very significant hand that has been given to all of us who are struggling over these years trying to bring about attention and reaction by the international community to these crises around Africa and more broadly in the world. And I think Don Cheadle and Paul Rusesabagina together create a tandem of almost moral force that is really, really I've rarely seen before. Paul is traveling all over the world raising money for his foundation and raising people's awareness of what is going on in Sudan today. And Don and I are writing a book together now. We just started about the situation in Sudan. And so there's a great commitment by both of those guys after the experiences that they've both gone through to really make a difference.
John Prendergast, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
John Prendergast is special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. Earlier, we heard from Brian Steidel, a former Marine captain who worked with the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. You can see some of Steidel's photographs of Darfur on our website at freshair.com.